From Montreal, Quebec, this is the Bard Brawl.
Welcome, Bard Brawlers, to the Bard Brawl. The Speeches Podcast. Taming of the Shrew. That's Mickey Lavelle sitting across from me.
Hello.
This is the first time we've had a speeches podcast where it hasn't just been myself and my co-creator of the Bard Brawl, the Renaissance scholar extraordinaire, Mr. Eric Jean.
Hello.
We've got two extra people here.
Yeah, and for the one of the first times, I'm sitting to your left, not to your right.
Ooh.
You guys are breaking with tradition big time. I don't know, is it the 13th or something?
We're making a move.
making a lot of moves. There's no boundaries. We go outside. There's no boxes here. We're on the outside of the box permanently, taking chances and doing a podcast about Shakespeare, which actually there's not very many of those. Jay Reed also joining us today. Jay Reed, you're inside. You must be happy.
Yes, yes. We were filming outside all weekend, and that was super fun, except for the fact that I can't feel my toes or my fingers anymore. So.
Or your soul.
My soul.
You've sold it for this movie.
I have sold my soul for this movie. That's true.
As his picture on the bardball.com.
Bardball.com picture.
Don't look at the picture, please.
That's
a dark moment.
Soon to be updated picture.
You can look at it, though, because it doesn't look anything like you. So you could be walking down the street, and all our thousands of bardball fans will not recognize you.
No, it looks like him. I've been there some of those nights.
It captures a moment in my life, and that's good.
It captures a certain one. You may hear chopping in the background. That is the one and only Stephanie E.M. Coleman. How did everybody like going through The Taming of the Shrew? Mickey, you like this play?
I like this play because up until the last act, it's very funny. And it's one of those plays that gains a lot by being staged.
Mm-hmm.
It's less funny on the page. It's always funny to watch, generally. So I've grown to like it.
Although as someone who's listened to all five of the acts, there's some pretty funny stuff in there. And I invite anyone to go to bardball.com or iTunes and listen to the first, well, all five acts of Taming of the Shrew. As read by a number of very funny, very talented readers, Andre, David, Sean, Verge...
And also us.
And
yes,
us.
I was
Hortensio.
You
yes.
were good
I was Hortensio. That was very fun. So we do a speeches podcast for each of the plays we do, where we go through the greatest speeches. This was a lot easier when we were doing The Merchant of Venice and Coriolanus.
It was.
Than this particular play. What do you think of the speeches or the dialogue or the poetry in The Taming of the Shrew?
There are some truly, as like you said, there are some truly funny moments. There are some good exchanges, but we had a really hard time finding anything involving the Lucentio Bianca Hortensio Grumio plot there, because it really is like plot. It's funny. There's physical comedy. There are some jokes, but there's really no meat to it. There's not much substance to it. We found the Kate and Petruchio plot line to be a lot more interesting.
I think it's the only part anyone ever remembers. When you're casting it, they're always the actors you need cast properly, and they're always the leads. And like Mickey was saying a number of times in the Barbell, how it's the Shrew tale is the Petruchio and Kate tale. And then the... What's the other one? The
Bianca
and Lucentio wooing, courtly love... story, and that one doesn't...
It's from an Italian... Well, it's not exactly from an Italian source, but it's got that... It's all surface, it's all sex jokes, and it loses a lot if you're not performing it, Mickey said.
It even loses something in the performance, because I think we had some reviews of some of the film versions. I did one, Mickey did one, Laura McDonald did one. All of them talked about Petruchio. I put a little slide in for some of the actors that I thought were good in the BBC version, but really, it's the mains, the lead. So, that being said, we will listen to our first speech. What is the first speech, Eric Jean? Can you set me up here?
Sure. The first speech in Act 1, Scene 2, is basically the speech where Petruchio's just arrived in the city, and he meets his friend Hortensio, and his friend
played
by Daniel.
Yep.
You do idiot douchebags really well.
I like them. I like them.
I like, as you'll see in the next play, I like really weak-willed monarchs.
Yeah,
but
it's true. You do.
The who knows? But Petruchio has just arrived in the city. He meets his friend Hortensio, and he tells Hortensio, "I'm here because I'm trying to get myself a rich wife." And Hortensio says, "No problem. I know who," but he seems hesitant to.
So let's listen to David Wheaton, one of the joys of this play. Yeah. David Wheaton is reading Petruchio.
"Such winds as scatters young men through the world to seek their fortunes farther than at home, where small experience grows. But in a few, Signor Hortensio, thus it stands with me. Antonio, my father, is deceased, and I have thrust myself into this maze, happily to wive and thrive as best I may. Crowns in my purse I have, and goods at home, and so am come abroad to see the world."
Petruchio, shall I then come roundly to thee and wish thee to a shrewd, ill-favored wife? Thou thank me but a little for my counsel, and yet I'll promise thee she shall be rich, and very rich, and thou'rt too much, my friend, and I'll not wish thee to her.
Signor Hortensio, twixt such friends as we, few words can suffice, and therefore, if thou know one rich enough to be Petruchio's wife, as wealth is burden of my wooing dance, be she as foul as was Florentius' love, as old as Sybil, and as cursed and shrewd as Socrates' Xanthippe, or worse,
nice.
She moves me not, or not removes at least, affection's edge in me. Were she as rough as are the swelling Adriatic seas, I come to wive it and wealthily in Padua, if wealthily, then happily in Padua."
I kind of thought that this was a good one. There is a bit of poetry in that, in this sort of, like, haberdash. This one version that the Bard on the Beach did in Vancouver, they had a swashbuckler style. And this speech kind of really plays into that. I just, whatever. I'm flying on the winds.
Booty.
Yeah. And there's that merchant boat theme again. As I said in the Bard Brawl, I think this is connected to the Merchant of Venice.
Antony.
Yes, Antonio. Yeah.
Antonio.
What did you think of the... How does this set the play?
This is interesting because it actually, the previous scene, we have Lucentio arriving with Tranio in the city. They have a discussion that's very different.
Mm-hmm.
Lucentio and Tranio just basically say, okay, you're here for school, but don't forget why you're here, to chase after some women and have a good time. And Petruchio comes in and he's all business. He's saying, okay, I'm here for one reason and one reason only, and that's to strike it rich. And I'm going to strike it rich by bagging a rich one.
Yeah.
And it sets up a class difference between the two of them right away, because one is obviously the son of a wealthy man whose father's still alive, we find out later. And whereas Petruchio, already you find out his father's dead. If there was money, it probably went to another son, so maybe he wasn't the firstborn son. So he's more already kind of the cowboy tossed out on the wind that's got to make his fortune, and back then you made your fortune by either going out to sea or marrying.
I like that idea. A cowboy. Dang of the shrew.
The Lucentio line was about, I'm here to study virtue or something.
Yeah.
And then he winds up being this sort of smarmy, manipulating, he's not that great of a character. He's really sort of despicable by the end, and gets humiliated by the girl that's supposed to be sort of the ditzy blonde. And
is he better or worse than Bianca?
Yeah,
that's a good question.
That's kind of.
They're both pretty horrible.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's what's. I mean, not to jump ahead to the end, but it's almost like you put one shrew down and three others pop up, and Bianca's definitely one of them. And they fit together really well.
Yeah.
The way that John Cleese pulls this line off, he just has that, like, well, just he's like so absolutely careless, and you're just like, as he goes, he starts to develop this sort of more and more, like, he gets more into the game. At the beginning, he doesn't really seem to care. Oh, what a fine segue into the next speech. Did you have anything else to say?
Nope, I'm good.
All right. Jay Reed, did you have anything to say?
Well,
what did you think of David Wheaton?
I thought David Wheaton was awesome.
Would you cast him in your movie?
I would. He's got a nice voice.
He was really excited when you talked about steak dinners.
Yeah?
He was really excited about that when you mentioned steak dinners.
Never had. Yeah.
He had never had a steak dinner.
No, they don't eat steak.
Oh, they don't eat steak there.
Oh. Lobster and mussels and stuff. Yeah, he's
those
a great, great ball hockey player, by the way. Take us into the second speech that we have chosen.
Okay, so
the bar brawl board.
The second speech. Patricio's been told about Kate, and so he's brought by his friends to Baptista, and they tell him, okay, great, here's this guy. He wants to meet your daughter. And so they arrange a meeting. And this is Patricio speaking about how he's going to sort of open up his courtship of Kate, how he's going to play it out, his strategy.
And we let it run a little bit for when Kate enters. And as Mickey said, during the bard brawl, this is the only time the two of them are together, alone, aside from the off stage and their nuptial chamber.
Where doing who knows what.
Well,
yeah,
he's doing
another,
but even then, they're surrounded by servants.
Yeah,
the only time I think that, I don't know, they're still, the Grumio's still around with them when they're walking back to.
The only other time that they're alone together is at the end of Act 5, Scene 1.
Where they kiss. Yeah.
And
but it's on the street.
It's a nice bookend here, though.
Yeah.
How they come in playing this sort of game. And then they end with this. It's kind of a sweet little scene.
It is actually. She goes, kiss you on the. It's the only moment, almost the little glimpse. If you want to buy into the fact that they love each other as a couple and are a match, because some people, like Harold Bloom, believe that. That's the moment.
Add a link to Harold Bloom's work on the book. So,
but it is the only tender moment. It really is the only one. And I actually
between any of them.
Yeah.
Because there's none. Bianca, you expect a big gushy thing with Bianca and Lucenzio, but it just. It goes from like, oh, flirty, to, oh,
but
geez,
she's
they're
clearly more interested in the courtship. Than
yeah.
Yeah.
The,
so let's listen to David and Stephanie Coleman reading
Kate.
Katarina, or plain Kate.
Signor Petruchio, will you go with us, or shall I send my daughter Kate to you?
I pray you do. I will attend her here.
Exit Baptista with Gremio, Tranio, and Hortensio. Manette Petruchio.
And woo her with some spirit when she comes. Say that she rail, why then I'll tell her plain. She sings as sweetly as a nightingale. Say that she frown, I'll say she looks as clear as morning roses newly washed with dew. Say she be mute and will not speak a word, then I'll commend her volubility and say she uttereth piercing eloquence. If she do bid me pack, I'll give her thanks as though she bid me stay by her a week. If she deny to wed, I'll crave the day when I shall ask the banns and when be married. But here she comes now. But here she comes, and now, Petruchio, speak.
Enter Katarina.
Good morrow, Kate, for that's your name, I hear.
Well, have you heard, but something hard of hearing, they call me Catherine that do talk of me.
You lie in faith, for you are called plain Kate, and bonnie Kate, and sometimes Kate the cursed. But Kate, the prettiest Kate in Christendom, Kate of Kate Hall, my super dainty Kate, for dainties are all Kates, and therefore, Kate, take this of me, Kate of my consolation. Hearing thy mildest praised in every town, thy virtue spoke of, and thy beauty sounded, yet not so deeply as to thee belongs, myself am moved to woo thee for my wife.
Moved? In good time, let him that moved you hither remove you hence. I knew you at the first you were immovable.
Why, what's immovable?
A joint stool.
Thou hast hit it. Come, sit on me.
Thou hast moved it. Come, sit on me. I believe you used that line when you met your now wife. That was your first line, if I remember correctly.
And it ends kind of like
this?
Yeah. Do you buy it as a modern listener to these type of things, Jay Reid, when you hear it, when you see this play? Does it feel really dated?
No. I don't actually think it does. Like, he's clearly, like, he's heard a lot of stuff about her, and he's overcompensating quite a bit, just trying to woo her.
So how would you do this if you were doing, I know you don't do a lot of rom-coms or anything like that, but if you were doing, like, a romance where there was a character you wanted to be manipulating someone, mm-hmm. how would you set that?
I guess I'd start off with, creating a background for the female character. So sort of finding, having people talk about her, you know, in a certain way. And then starting off with the guy, he's kind of, you know, into her, but he knows that he has to act a certain way to get with her. So he would definitely be a very manipulative character, obviously.
Like, see, that's that's the interesting thing about this play, is he doesn't actually think, he's not into her. He just sort of, like you said, he's like a cowboy. That's what I find kind of interesting about his character.
This is his Tom Cruise moment, though, because what he's doing
I like where this is going. Which Tom Cruise?
The real one.
Oh, the real life one. Wow.
Because what he did with Katie Holmes is he tried to change her identity by changing her name to Kate.
Ah.
Really?
So, what, because if you want to, what you want to do, if you buy in, again, to the Stockholm Syndrome part of the play, if you want to fart with someone's identity, can I swear on the podcast?
Sure.
If you want to fuck with someone's identity, change their name.
That's interesting. And she swore.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. We're finally getting some brawl.
Yeah, the brawl is coming, and Tom Cruise got brought up. And did you read that Vanity Fair article about...
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
That's pretty incredible. Yes.
And he also tried to change Nicole's name to Nick.
Nikki.
So yeah, see, Nick, yeah. See, I tell you, this is his Tom Cruise moment.
Why?
Well, that's it. Mind. Now my mission in life is to have to stage a Taming of the Shrew with Tom Cruise as Petruchio.
Yeah. He would actually make a good Petruchio.
I know.
It's a pretty good, it's not a bad casting for it. Well, this is the, I think when we first read this for the Bar Brawl group way back when, I was like, this is kind of crazy, and he's just, like, torturing and manipulating this person, and it's really kind of nasty. And I guess that still kind of plays, but it's an interesting...
Well, the later scenes are a lot more like that, but this scene is definitely believable. I think it's not any different than, like, some guy meets a girl in a bar, and he gives her just a little bit of attitude, and she sort of gives a little attitude back. But, like, I don't see that as being that different.
I was never good at that. Giving attitude. I was.
No, you
do. You have to read the game.
It strikes me as the attitude.
You don't see
it. You want to come to my Shakespeare club? Yeah.
But that's the whole basis of these pickup artists, that all this, their logic, their plan, that's how you do it. You sort of insult a bit, and then the girl will insult back, and as you do that, you sort of build a sort of weird kind of capital. I don't know. It's like strange, but.
He returns to this formula in Much Ado About Nothing. Yes. And I think it works a lot better in that play, because there's more better characters than just the two. But the Benedict and Beatrice...
There's more background, too, to both characters. Like, here, we have only what other people have been saying about Kate.
Yeah.
And, or Catherine, or Katharina, or whichever. And also, we know nothing about Petruchio. He shows up and he says, "I want to get I want to get some money and marry rich." Like,
and he's from where he said he's from Pisa, or where do you say he was from again? Venice or something. But then he has a country house right outside of Padua. What is he doing in Padua anyway? All questions that are there
unanswered.
For any of our Bard Brawl listeners can feel free to comment and tell us where you think it's coming from. So we go from this, where he's planned to do all of this and tame her like a falcon and blah, blah, blah. He goes back to his, they have the wedding, he wears a goofy hat. It's hilarious, because hats are funny.
He has probably funny pantaloons.
Funny pantaloons are also funny. And then he takes her for their blissful honeymoon in the country, which is usually staged in a dark attic of some kind, or, and just...
which misses the point, I think.
Blatantly tortures her.
I don't see why it should be staged in an attic. He wants to overdo it with the kindness. I feel like it'd be even worse to put her in this really opulent bedroom and then, like... Anyways.
Yeah, the play we saw in the summer, they had, like, a hole that they would just... They would throw things in, yeah, like a pit. Which was, it kind of, it worked for the stage, like whenever she would eat anything, you'd throw it in the hole.
They put her in the hole?
Not her.
Okay.
But there was this kind of a drum in the middle and you'd throw things in it.
Oh.
It was pretty, it was kind of clever.
It makes sense that his house be sort of bare basics, though, because it's supposed to be the marriage from hell for her. So if she were to show up and... this really warm, opulent, sort of welcoming atmosphere that goes against the grain of everything what's happening. She's coming to this cold, bare basics, but cobwebby.
But isn't, like Eric said, that's a little obvious? Like, yo, what a surprise. She's in, like, the dumps. Because he shows up driving a, like, dressed up all goofy and he for his wedding day. And I think it might be kind of interesting to put him in a spa jacuzzi or something and never let her touch. Because think about torture, if I know anything about torture.
Torturing with kindness.
Torture. And you just leave it out of the reach of them. That's...
Mess with their mind so even I've heard.
Oh, okay.
So the second, this speech, where are we? What is going on?
Petruchio has just brought Kate home. And he's... already denied her food, basically, saying that the food wasn't good enough for her to eat, and sent her off to bed without her dinner. And this is where he tells us, I guess, phase two of his plan. Now that phase one has been successful and he was able to... Well, I guess he didn't even really win her, but he was able to make it convincing enough to Baptista that he didn't care. But now that he's won Kate, now he's got to find a way to break her. So this is...
Yeah. He doesn't break her before he marries her. He breaks her. And I left a few of the servants in the beginning. The servant Curtis. The strangely named Curtis. Very common Italian
Peter?
Name.
Nathaniel. Yeah, very, very... We wonder how close to England Padua is.
All right. And it's David Wheaton again as Petruchio, as per normal.
Peter, didst ever see the like?
He kills her in her own humor.
Re-enter Curtis.
Where is he?
In her chamber, making a sermon of continency to her. Nice. And rails and swears and rates that she, poor soul, knows not which way to stand, to look, to speak, and sits as one new risen from a dream. Away, away, for he's coming hither.
Exit. Re-enter Petruchio.
Thus have I politically begun my reign, and 'tis my hope to end successfully. My falcon now is sharp and passing empty, and till she stoops she must not be full gorged, for then she never looks upon her lure. Another way I have to man my haggard, to make her come and know her keeper's call, that is to watch her, as we watch these kites that bait and beat, and will not be obedient. She eat no meat today, nor none shall eat. Last night she slept not, nor tonight she shall not. As with the meat, some undeserved fault I'll find about the making of the bed. And here I'll fling the pillow, there the bolster, this way the coverlet, another way the sheets. Aye, and amid this hurly I intend that all is done in reverent care of her. And in conclusion she shall watch all night, and if she chance to nod, I'll rail and brawl, and with the clamor keep her still awake. This is a way to kill a wife with kindness, and thus I'll curb her mad and headstrong humor. He that knows better how to tame a shrew, now let him speak. 'Tis charity to show.
Exit. Yes, I was I was taking notes. Apparently I was really moved by David's reading there. Huh, I didn't do any of that. But I guess it worked out all right. So we discussed the birds that everybody would like on their shoulder, and three of the brawlers went with Raven without missing a beat. Interesting. I don't know what that says about people's personalities, but...
Scary.
Yes, scary. Mysterious, dark. Yeah. But Raven, not Crow.
No, it's a bigger bird. Troubling.
It's heavy.
It's a bit troubling, I think.
Yeah, I chose Owl. Although Stephanie chose Flamingo. Everybody's there. The sermon, I love the line, Jay, you read. He's in there... Yeah, what's the line? Sermon.
Sermonizing her about constancy.
A sermon of constancy?
Yeah. It's it's funny to imagine, and I kind of want to be able to see Petruchio giving a sermon to this tired, hungry woman that's just so... And the John Cleese version, he's yawning it when he's doing the scene. He's really tired, and you think about how tiring it would be for him to keep up the energy to torture her for that long. It must be really tiring for those torturers. Although I guess
I wouldn't know.
I guess normal torturers get breaks.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they get breaks. I mean, you know, you need some time to get over the fact that you just tortured somebody.
Plus, they usually go in shifts, right? Yeah. I mean, he takes it. Let's not underestimate him. He takes it all on himself. He does it all. So he does it directly. He's very hands on. He could have passed this off to Curtis or someone like that.
Curtis. Grêmio. Yeah. What's his servant again? Grêmio? Grêmio?
Grêmio.
Never remember which one.
Well, Grêmio is the old man.
Yeah.
After reading this for, I think, the third time, I find this like, all right, Grêmio, old man, got it. I think you read Grêmio, too.
I did.
Grêmio, E for elder. Grêmio, U for underling.
Oh, good. Very nice.
Good one, Eric.
So we will leave... Like Eric said, we were scouring to find something of the other characters in it, but like with some of Shakespeare's earlier plays, they're very like one character gets all of the good stuff.
He becomes really good later on as his writing career goes on. He becomes really good at using minor characters to deepen his play, to like take it in interesting directions. So you end up with these throwaway characters who have amazing lines in all sorts of plays.
Jessica and Merchant of Venice.
But this just isn't one of those. It just doesn't have that many secondary characters with... And even the main characters aren't that sharp, always.
Yeah. The, like, when we did the Merchant of Venice, we were talking about Jessica and talking about all these other characters. And this one, they're sort of there to drive plot. They have a little bit of fun, and there's a bit of slapstick, and Beyond Delos is some funny stuff, but there's not much more than, like, slapstick sometimes with them, I found, reading. So, Mickey, lead us into the last speech.
Ooh, that's the big one, the headbender, mind twister. What the hell was he thinking when he wrote this
David
speech?
Lynch movie.
This is when you might have been able to take the play all the way up to that point, because even if Kate is being, let's say, treated badly, all the other characters are kind of tossed around the stage as well. There's a lot of punching and slapsticking and door slamming and everyone is very physical with everybody. So it kind of, you can kind of go with it even to a certain extent until the speech. And God knows, if we could only get in a time machine and go back and ask him, patron said, you have to have this speech in here. Who knows why it's there, but it's the one that...
I really wonder.
All the papers are written about the last speech, folks.
Here it is, the last speech. It is Katharina, read by Miss Stephanie E. M. Coleman.
5-5. Unknit that threatening, unkind brow, and dart not scornful glances from those eyes to wound thy lord, thy king, thy governor. It blots thy beauty as frost do bite the meads, confounds thy fame as whirlwinds shake fair buds, and in no sense is meet or amiable. A woman moved is like a fountain troubled, muddy, ill-seeming, thick, bereft of beauty, and while it is so, none so dry or thirsty will deign to sip or touch one drop of it. Thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee and for thy maintenance, commits his body to painful labor both by sea and land, to watch the night in storms, day in cold, whilst thou liest warm at home, secure and safe, and craves no other tribute at thy hands but love, fair looks, and true obedience. Too little payment for so great a debt. Such duty as the subject owes the prince, even such a woman oweth to her husband. And when she is froward, peevish, sullen, sour, and not obedient to his honest will, what is she but a foul, contending rebel and graceless traitor to her loving lord? I am ashamed that women are so simple, to offer war where they should kneel for peace, or seek for rule, supremacy, and sway, when they are bound to serve, love, and obey. Why are our bodies soft and weak and smooth, unapt to toil and trouble in the world, but that our soft conditions and our hearts should well agree with our external parts? Come, come, you froward and unable worms. My mind hath been as big as one of yours. My heart is great, my reason haply more, to bandy word for word and frown for frown. But now I see our lances are but straws, our strength is weak, our weakness past compare, that seeming to be most which we indeed least are. Then veil your stomachs, for it is no boot, and place your hands below your husband's foot. In token of which duty, if he please, my hand is ready, may it do him ease.
And finally, Catherine decides that the man is the head of the household, and the world as well.
Well, I'm gonna start and go with the, how does this make sense? And then we can, how does this make sense? She spends five acts, well, let's say four acts, trying to make his life hell, only to realize when everything is said and done that she actually has no power to do anything other than argue with him. He has the power to deny her food. He has the power to deny her sleep. At least that's what's being set up here. And so in the end, if you want to read it sort of straight and figure out, well, how does this make sense to someone in 1592? It's, I have what you think you have in terms of power, ladies, really is the indulgence that men allow you. That's the logic that the play is basically saying. That's the speech he's saying. Mm.
Which is not a huge reveal in a way. Like, I mean, it's hard to swallow.
Yeah, I mean, it's economic truth at the time. You're like, you come with the money, but you don't have the power to use it for yourself. You have only the power to bring it to me so I can... Shitty situation.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
Yeah. I don't know, just... the whole play is kind of... ridiculous, like how they're trying to, he's trying to break this woman, and then at the end she's like, yeah, that's it,
you win.
Like,
she didn't even really say you win.
Shakespeare have something against one of his girlfriends or,
well,
revenge play.
Yeah, she's like, I got you good.
Yeah, the last time you leave me there at that coffee shop.
I was waiting.
As far as the Shrew plays, like, is this the standard ending?
Well, exactly. This is, what he's done is he takes, of course, the two narratives, the courtly love story, the Shrew tale, and he throws them both on the stage, and they both end as they're supposed to end, and that the courtly gentleman gets the beautiful bride, and the tamer tames the Shrew. So in some ways, that's it. This is supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely predictable. It wouldn't have been a shock to anybody. Well, actually, I say that, but the play was actually contentious fairly early on, because it's so long. I think that's, and because it is so different from the tone of the rest of the play, which is this kind of hijinks that's going on. And all of a sudden she gets up and she gives this very, if you read it in a certain way, heartfelt, this is the way to be a woman. This is the way to be a good wife, and it's so long, and she goes on so long. So I think that's why people go, why so much, Will? Why so much?
Why did she talk? He also bounces off what we talked about just a second ago, about that charming little scene at the end of Act 5, Scene 1, where the two of them sort of start to get it. Like, let's watch this disaster ensue and listen to Barbrawl Act 5 and you'll hear what I'm talking about. Where the actually, that was pretty funny because Jay was talking to himself a lot, and so we decided that the transformer noise would be noise when you transform characters.
Actually, two of us in the scene, I think it was me and Eric, and we both played.
Both wound up talking to each other. Wasn't the best directing of characters. I guess that's my bad. But they're both like, let's watch these goofballs, and you sort of get this feeling like they're both in on the game.
Yeah.
And the way some of them will stage the play is that she's screwing with the others who are betting.
Yeah, because you're right. Because before that, the widow insults her, everyone insults her, and kind of insults, and Petruchio kind of has her back in that moment.
Yeah.
When everyone starts picking on her as his wife, you can see that he doesn't like it either. And it is, and what Shakespeare does give them plot-wise is they win all the money.
Yeah.
So in a way, he hands the play to the two of them as a couple.
And you kind of imagine, I mean, whatever you think of Petruchio's methods and whatever, you kind of think they're the only couple who will be happy. I kind of look at it and I don't worry about them. I'm like, they've figured it out. They found some middle ground. And I like the end of Act 5, Scene 1, because it really does give that impression like they're playing a game together. And they realize that all these idiots are trying to play some weird game or keep up with some image, and they've moved past it somehow, and they're like, well, let's just go laugh at all these people and we'll enjoy our little peace and quiet off to the side.
And I will invite you to read Laura McDonald's review of 10 Things I Hate About You, and she brings up 10 things she hates about this movie. It's kind of asking for that.
Yeah.
But one of the things was that Julia Stiles, the Kate character, she starts crying when she recites a sonnet, as if she's sort of this sappy, love-crazed. But that's really not Kate. There's no point where she's like, oh, I really just wanted a husband and I finally found one. Like, it doesn't really work like that. And the movie, of course, is supposed to be for teenagers, and that makes sense. But she also criticized there's way too many midriffs. Remember that era?
The midriff phase.
The midriff era? That was like late 90s?
Yeah.
It was good times.
Yeah.
Lots of belly buttons. And the other thing about this, and we brought it up in the podcast itself, was just the staging. I have yet to see it staged well. Like, this last scene, they always just clunk everybody down at a banquet table, and it's like, either on stage you have this sort of congressional hearing sort of idea where everyone's lined up side by side, and that really doesn't work well on stage, or on screen they do the same thing, line them up along a board table, and it's just so, because so much of the play is them running around and beating each other and all of these sort of things, and there's no reason that you have to set it like that, but it's sort of the most uninventive.
There is an overall just static. The play comes to this kind of static lull.
Crashes. It's nice. That's a good sound effect. We don't need extra sound effects. It's really good. Anyway, that was Taming of the Shrew. I thank all of you for listening to any or all of the previous acts or this speeches podcast. We'll return next time. And when we say next week, by the way, we usually mean next time. We do try and get them out every week, but things come up and we have day jobs. So.
And it snows and we have to get our way through snowbanks.
Snow is coming. And just in time for snow, we're going to dig into a nice cold history play. I'm not going to say which one, but I will give you the hint. Nobody ever reads it.
So, kids, if you have to do this one for class, just listen to the Barbrawl.
You'll never have to do this one for class.
You probably won't ever have to, but this is your only source. I think we sold it. Everyone's coming back.
It's going to be awesome. There's
There's some good bits. There's some.
There is some.
There's
good
an
bits.
Awesome character.
There's a lot of actually some pretty decent characters, and we read through it.
Couple of famous
during
speeches.
The nights, and there's some decent speeches. There's a lot of characters, and it was one of the most popular plays at the time.
Yeah.
Not anymore. But I would like to see someone put it on because I think there's potential.
It'd make a good movie.
I think it would.
An epic trilogy.
Yeah. Oh,
there's lots of battles.
You almost ruined
oh,
it.
Hint. That was a big hint.
That was a big hint. Yeah. Sort of.
We better stop talking.
Okay. Okay. Please go to thebarbrawl.com and leave us a comment on this or any other posts. Like us on Facebook. Did you like us on Facebook, Jay Reed?
I'm pretty sure I did.
Yeah. Well, your picture's there.
Probably should now.
Go to the Barbrawl and like Jay Reed's picture.
Yes.
It was from a different time in his life.
I think it's an awesome picture.
I think it's nice, yeah. It's against the,
it's very
the
grisly.
Brick. It's grisly.
It's dark.
Yeah.
It's dark.
Yeah.
You know that guy.
He looks deep and troubled. It's a poetic.
If you ever wind up standing over a body, you know that's the guy who will just kind of come in and figure it out.
He does look like he's kind of standing over a body.
He isn't looking at the camera.
He's looking down, isn't he? I think he's
looking
down.
Yeah, he's looking down. Well, now everybody's going to come there. So go by. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can also leave comments and rate it. Stars. You can add stars. Mm. There's currently not enough ratings for it to have an official rating.
Can I plug the sonnets again?
Yes.
Because I the sonnets are great. There's a lot of great information on the sonnets, and the sonnets often get overlooked because education doesn't have enough time to read all,
150 almost.
So mostly you read like a couple.
Yeah.
It's usually the same ones.
Yeah. So I personally would plug the sonnet.
Well, there's a sonnet at the end of each podcast, and we have done one sonnet podcast with five sonnets, me and Eric and Maya Pankala.
Which is great.
There'll be another one coming up after the next play that we do. I always add the sonnets at the end because I thought that would be a great way to teach Shakespeare's, to like give kids a play and then make them do a sonnet after, and no one really ever does that. And I guess because, you know, they have their lesson plans or whatever, but I was...
It's like eating an airplane, one bit at a time.
Eating an airplane?
Yes, there's a man who's famous for eating a Boeing 747.
A little bit
at a time. It took him many years.
Wow. Man, there's all kinds of odd knowledge you pick up with this podcast.
Yeah, that's true. One time Sean Malley described, I had to cut it because it went on for a while, he described how The Phantom Menace originally was supposed to be Othello. A version of Othello. The Star Wars Phantom Menace.
Is that
Phantom
why
Menace.
Mace Windu, Windu or whatever was...
It didn't work out that way.
So who was Jar Jar?
Jar Jar would have been, I guess, Cassio?
Banquo?
He would have been the guy who... Iago tortures and kills.
Oh, Rodrigo.
I would say he'd probably be Rodrigo.
That makes sense.
Or maybe that's Yoda. No, Yoda's too smart. Oh, I can't believe I'm thinking about which characters from The Phantom Menace would be Othello. Wow. Well, that just gave everybody just something to think about. Thank you! See you next time!
Sonnet 26. Lord of my love, to whom in vassalage thy merit hath my duty strongly knit, to thee I send this written embassage, to witness duty, not to show my wit. Duty so great, which wit so poor as mine, may make seem bare in wanting words to show it, but that I hope some good conceit of thine in thy soul's thought all naked will bestow it, till whatsoever star that guides my moving points on me graciously with fair aspect, and puts apparel on my tattered loving to show me worthy of thy sweet respect. Then may I dare to boast how I do love thee, till then not show my head where thou mayest prove me.